we've all been touched by inequities and injustices in our lives, but our story is really what drives what matters to us, right? But until we understand ourselves, we can't impact anything.
This is SITREP, the New York City Department of Veterans Services podcast, where we aim to inform and inspire by bringing you the stories of New York City veterans, military service members, their families, and civilian supporters. I'm your host, Gabe Ramos, U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Deputy Press Secretary here at DVS. On today's episode, we hear from Pam Campos Palma. Pam is an Air Force veteran, organizer, strategist, and about as fierce and inspiring an advocate as you'll find. We talk about what fuels the work she does, the experiences that have shaped her life and career, and what's needed to fix imbalances in power. Enjoy the show. All right, so we are here with Pam Campos Palma. Pam is a veteran of the U.S. Air Force. She's currently a political strategist, movement leader, and organizer. Pam, thanks so much for being here.
Lovely to be here.
I'll start with this, because when we first started brainstorming the idea of putting this podcast together, I knew that you were one of the people that I definitely wanted to speak to. So I can't tell you how excited I am to have you here, and I'm really looking forward to chatting.
Awesome.
So I guess we could just pretty much start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So I know you're originally from Quincy, Massachusetts. If you could just talk a little bit about your background and specifically about the role that kind of played in your life.
Mm-hmm. I was born in Boston, raised in Quincy, Massachusetts, in a very blue-collar Irish Catholic community. Where I first grew up, it was very diverse, and then I was plucked out of that neighborhood to a more affluent neighborhood to go to a gifted children's program. And yeah, I really believe and how those roots shaped me and how they like propelled me into the military, into what I'm doing today. But I grew up with a lot of folks that looked different from me. Mm. My mother is a Honduran immigrant. We grew up pretty working class. And so I saw a lot of things when I was a child that made me very curious about politics and power and, you know, how I could see myself with family that was very different. Right. My friends' families and then my own families. So
when you say that you kind of saw things in terms of kind of power dynamics, I was wondering if you could just kind of expound a little bit about that and kind of how that shaped you.
Yeah. I mean, explicitly, I experienced racism and classism when I was a kid, right? Mm-hmm. I think that the way that we experience life really shapes our worldview. Growing up with my mom, seeing folks tell her not to speak Spanish to me in the laundromat, right? Mm-hmm. To speak English because you're in America. But at the same time, my mom is probably the biggest red, white, and blue flags all around our house. Right. 4th of July is like Christmas. And it was actually my mom who asked me to join the military.
Oh, okay.
So it was just very interesting to see that dichotomy, right. I think.
And what was her thinking in saying the military would be a good place for you?
I think she saw an Air Force commercial once and was like, whoa, you could be a pilot.
Right.
But I think really what it came down to is, you know, I found myself in a gifted children's program with mostly rich white kids. And I didn't know anybody really who had gone to college. I didn't understand how college worked. My mom had never as well. And so really in first generation mode, my mom said, that's the opportunity that will give you chance to upward mobility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about kind of growing up around a bunch of kind of rich white kids.
Yeah.
The reason I want to go back to that is because that's something that I kind of connect to, just kind of growing up in a upper middle class, kind of affluent neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I know you said yours is a little bit more blue collar, but then kind of going to school with rich white kids. And there was a lot of these things looking back now that you don't kind of realize the extent to which they shape you, those experiences, those interactions, and dealing with those folks and being the token brown kid, being,
right.
You know, one of, you know, maybe two, and just the kind of series of microaggressions and things that you go through. And,
mm-hmm.
But that you don't really realize in the moment, you're like, hey, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. This isn't the way that people are supposed to talk to me or how I'm supposed to be interacting
right.
with folks. So I'm wondering if you could connect with that at all, if there's anything there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it persisted, I think, even now.
Yeah.
I still experience people being like, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be, you know. at the governor's house, right? You're not supposed to be in this level of position in politics. So, yeah, I think growing up, I didn't even realize what was happening, right? What I find fascinating is that growing up, I didn't really understand. People around me didn't talk about politics, but I knew it was political,
right?
And so I think that that definitely shaped me in a very particular way, where I was very interested in differences, but also bonds, right? I saw my friends' parents who, you know, worked in unions, and then I saw my own mom who was working in nursing homes, and there was a lot of similarities, and yet my friend's dad was kind of racist, right? So that always really interested me, yeah.
So when your mom comes to you with this kind of grand solution of saying, hey, the way out's going in the Air Force, what are you thinking? What's going through your head at that point?
So I actually wanted to be an artist. Yeah. I was very, even then, I think I was very, I was very interested in how to connect people, and I was very passionate about art. So I was very resistant. I was like, me in the military, what? And I also didn't know anybody who had ever served. So I didn't understand the mechanics of like boot camp and tech school. It was literally like jumping into a black hole. Mm. And I think for both of us, it was terrifying. I think a lot of folks, to be an immigrant in America and already kind of be starting from zero, right? To then give your child to the military is terrifying, I think, right? So I resisted it. But as an immigrant kid, I listened to my mom.
Of course.
And, you know, I even remember when the recruiter gave me the book, the big book of jobs.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what any of it meant, but I knew that Intel had the longest school. And I thought, intelligence, I might be working with intelligent people that might give me good options afterwards, right? And literally, I chose a job that I had no idea about based off of just, like, hope,
right? Yeah, because you're, what, 18, 19 years old, you don't really know, you know, you're still figuring out, your brain's still developing, so you don't really have an idea of how things work and things. So, all right, so you leave Massachusetts, you go to the Air Force. What was your experience like in the Air Force? Because I know that you kind of like thrown to the wolves right away in terms of, you know, you're 18, 19 years old and you have this pretty, you know, high level of responsibility. Mm-hmm. So what was that like? How did you kind of process that?
Yeah, I mean, what I found when I went to boot camp, and I still think about this a lot, is that it wasn't as shocking. I wasn't as shocked, I think, as some other people I saw at boot camp. And what I mean by that is that I think because I had grown up kind of gritty, right, in Quincy, you know, people yelling at each other, not really a surprise to me, right? I saw a lot of people. I saw more people of color in boot camp than I did at my school,
right?
And another thing that folks don't know about me is that I was pretty rebellious in high school because I like didn't feel like I fit in and school wasn't a safe place. I became very rebellious even though I was one of the top students, and I didn't get to walk in my high school graduation.
Because you weren't doing well necessarily in school, or because you were just lashing out? Like
because I didn't show up.
There you go.
So I think when I joined the Air Force, especially when I went to Intel school, I really wanted to prove myself.
Right.
I knew that I was smart. And Intel graduation was actually the first time I ever walked across the stage.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my attitude was, all right, this is a challenge. It feels familiar, right? Being Latina, I thought the Air Force core values mirrored a lot of what my mom taught me, right? Integrity first, service before self, excellence in all we do. That's how I was raised. And I ended up being a very, like, I don't know how to say it, like that kind of like airman that like just wants to like do
gung-ho
stuff. Yeah, I was a very gung-ho airman. And
in the Marine Corps, we call them MODO.
Okay.
Yeah. they're the ones who like 5 years in, they still have a high and tight and they're still going around and barking at folks.
Oh, I wasn't like that. I was more, I think I was known as very eager to do the work. So I was the person that would like stay late to brief the cops, right? I was the person that would really kind of work with other enlisted folks.
Did that come from a place of wanting to prove yourself or like needing to prove yourself? Or was it just because you were passionate about the work, or to what do you attribute that?
I think that I realized that I was good at intel,
right.
But I also felt that I needed to prove myself, one, just for myself, and also as a woman of color, right? I remember one of the first things someone said to me in the office, it was like day two in my intel office, and I asked someone, can you show me how to use a fax machine? I'd never used a fax machine, and he said, I thought you were here already knowing how to do that stuff and making coffee. That's what you're here
because
to do.
You're a woman.
Because I was a woman.
Right.
Yeah.
You get the handbook as a woman.
Right.
Right. How to brew coffee. Yeah.
Right. So I think that that set the tone for me to be like, all right, I'm going to show you that I'm good at this job.
There you go.
And I did. I proved a lot. I think I did right off the bat. I proved that I was good at intel and I got to do high level things, even as like an E2.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you were in for how long total?
So I was active duty for about 4 years, and then I was a reservist, like heavy reserve duty, while also going to school. I was also a reservist while I was still doing grad school.
Wow.
Here in New York.
Yeah.
And my unit was in Washington State.
That's an intense schedule there.
Yeah, yeah.
So and going in, did you say, I'm going to make this four and out or four in reserves or four in – what was your kind of mindset in terms of length of how long you wanted to stay in uniform?
Yeah. I think like a lot of folks, my military experience was a lot of good and mm-hmm. it was a lot of tough.
Of course.
So my first unit was wonderful. I, you know, had mentors. I remember I had a captain who taught me what college credits were.
Mm-hmm.
And then the latter part of my active duty career, I was in a unit that was fraught with fraud, waste, abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And abuse of power. And so even though I knew there was a part of me, I often say that I started organizing in the military. There was a part of me mid-career where I was like, don't ask, don't tell was happening. Sexual assault was happening. I saw officers mistreat enlisted. I even had an officer that was explicitly sexist and racist. And so I started kind of becoming the military is the worst place to organize, but I started
you would think so, yeah.
organizing other junior enlisted.
There's not a lot of opportunities to get folks around from your commanders.
Right. Yeah. So there was a part of me, and there was a lot of folks that were like, you should commission. You'd be a great officer.
Mm.
And there was a part of me that was so hopeful that I could make change from the inside. Yeah. I did feel like I could be a great leader, that I could, you know, bring changes to the Air Force culture. And so that's what actually... I didn't think I could stay in active duty to do that.
No.
I felt like, nope, active duty is not the place for me. But I continued into the reserves because I was hopeful. But then even when I was in the reserves, I was organizing then externally. I was mm-hmm. getting into politics and being intel in politics.
Yeah.
I had to make a choice.
So you say that you kind of got that bug for organizing and mm-hmm. you know you're focused on these power dynamics and how you want to affect change. Did you say, I'm going to go reserves, I'm going to go out because, I guess the lens that you, through you, which you were looking at it was it more, I want to affect change a kind of a grander scale in the military? What was your mindset in that time?
I think two things. So I think there was a part of me that was fearful of transition. So that's one thing. I like stayed naturally. In the reserves because it was security.
Right.
Right. But there was a part of me that was deeply, I felt responsible for troops. I felt responsible for people I served with. I knew that today it's me. Tomorrow there's another person that's going to come up behind me that might be mistreated, right? Yeah. And so I wasn't sure at what level of impact I could make, but I knew I could make an impact, right? I knew that there were ways that I could change the sexual assault training to not be segregated, right?
Which
makes
course,
sense,
yeah.
Right? So small ways. And also I took a lot of pride in being the best NCO I could be. And even in the reserves, I was pushed into another commission, right? Mm. So I think it was a growing moment where I was trying to figure out in my leadership, what can I do?
Right. Where can I maximize my efforts here to get the kind of the most bang for my buck, so to speak?
Exactly.
So talk a little bit about your kind of post-uniform, post-military work, because it's been a lot, and you've affected a lot of change, and there's been a lot of organizing
right.
and strategizing. So talk a little bit about that, if you could.
Yeah, there was a moment where, you know, I was in uniform, I was in Oregon, I was going to school and just trying to figure out transition, you know, my transition, I feel like, was long, because even though I was still doing stuff, I felt very isolated and alone, and I felt a lot of imposter syndrome, right? But I think that...
Which I want to just highlight is pretty universal, not just for folks. Well, I think probably, you know, folks transitioning out of uniform, they kind of feel it pretty intensely, but I think any kind of individual going through a major change of, you know, facing new options and kind of what to do next, there's a lot of where do I fit in this kind of grand scheme of things.
So, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And I met amazing people in the military. There were several folks that I still are some of my best friends, but I was deeply starved for community. I felt so starved for my identity. You go into the military, you put on that uniform, you're all the same.
Right.
But I couldn't take my brownness off, you know, I couldn't take being a woman off. And so I was really eager to find community with other Latinos, people of color, women. And so I threw myself into immigrant rights organizing while I was a reservist, while I was an undergrad. And I learned a lot. I had a lot of folks that saw something in me and said, yeah, you're a veteran and you're also all these other things. And you can impact change in your community because you're also Latina. You come from immigrants. And that really opened up my world, I think, to politics. And I'm the kind of person that once I throw myself into something, like, I just do it, you know, and I do it hard. And so, yeah, I was a gubernatorial appointee. I just kind of kept throwing myself into organizing, especially around my biggest, I think, passion is a question around power, right? Who has it? Who doesn't? And why is it? Who makes the rules, right? And so through that, I did a lot of different things, political parity, you know, international development. So it's been a winding road, I think, of just organizing.
So when you talk about, obviously, you know, you're very strongly focused on these kind of power dynamics and this power imbalance. And there's so many levels to it, right? So you talk about being a woman of color, being an immigrant, being, you know, veteran, which kind of has its own power dynamic. So how do you kind of go about saying, all right, now I, like, where do you start, essentially, right? So you have so many aspects of who you are, how you identify. So when you have such a large problem to tackle, how do you go about figuring out, okay, this is step one?
Right. Yeah, I mean, a lot of my work has really focused on leadership development and harnessing our own stories, right? And knowing that we have a lot of individual power, right? But that's kind of where it starts, is what matters to us? Right. What are our life experiences? What has driven and changed us, right? So from immigrant rights organizing to, like, organizing in Central America to veterans organizing most recently, the thing I care most about is, do people see their own power in any situation, right? I don't like how the government is running. I don't like what's happening at the VA. Climate, racial justice. We've all been touched by inequities and injustices in our lives, but our story is really what drives what matters to us, right? But until we understand ourselves, we can't impact anything. So a lot of my work has really been in cultivating more leaders, right? Leaders in any kind of space that need stories that are not being told.
So how do you go to somebody? How do you make them see that, right? Because it's it's so easy to say, you know, to be defeatist, to kind of look at the world cynically and, oh, there's nothing I could do. Just kind of throw my hands up. This is the way it is. So how do you mobilize folks? How do you do that? What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most impactful eras of my organizing career has been the last 2 years, right? 2016 happened. So one piece that I think I left out that I want to go back to is that I came to New York to go to grad school. So I, after Oregon, I was really kind of, what else could I do, right? But I went to NYU for grad school, and I graduated in 2016, and the election was happening. And I, for a long time, have really had a question around veterans in politics, right? There's a lot of stereotypes and generalizations that we're all straight, white dudes that are right-leaning, mm-hmm. Christian. And yes, we are. And also, right, what a disservice and what a danger that is, right, to the full story of who we are and the breadth and power that we have as a community. So the last 2 years, that's what I've been doing, is organizing veterans on the left, which is a broad spectrum of folks, as we know, right? But for me, it's really about connection. Mm-hmm. The most important change work comes from relationships, connection, and story. And so a lot of what I do is really talking to vets, talking to people, and trying to understand their stories. And once people start hearing their story, people remind themselves that they're passionate or angry or upset. And that drives change, right? Absolutely. We can be cynical all we want, but their passion and hope is what actually gets people over that hump, right? And so I listen to people and people say, you know, I'm tired of being a vet and being a woman and nobody really listening to my story. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of my work is to get people past the anger and past the, like, there's an injustice, to then what are we going to do about it then?
Right. How do you make that into actionable work and change now? And it's funny you bring up anger, because when I think about, you know, obviously I'm a little bit removed from the work that you do, but when I look at kind of the trajectory of the last 2 years and just seeing, you know, how active you've been, it kind of reminds me of this book that I just read, Good and Mad by Rebecca Traister, and how she talks about, you know, how anger, and in particular women's anger, has kind of shaped political and social movements.
Yeah.
And it's how been a channeling of that, right? From women's suffrage to civil rights to, you know, first and second wave feminism, all the way through Me Too and where we're at today.
Mm-hmm.
And just how that's been a large part of the catalyst of the changes that have happened in this country. You know, when you think of Rosa Parks, she wasn't just some woman who sat and got tired of sitting on a bus. You know, that was the culmination of a lifetime worth of activism and being out on the front lines. So, to you, I guess I would ask, kind of, what role does anger play? How do you channel it? How do you use it? How to fuel you? Or do you use it at all? Does anger play a part in it at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially now, especially speaking for myself, right? I often think about how in my life I've not seen a prosperous America, a prosperous and peaceful America that I know that we can be, right? And it's upsetting. Mm-hmm. It's upsetting. And I think that our generation has been through a lot of painful points. And I do use injustice. I don't know about anger, but we all do share commonalities, right? So there are times where I know that there's someone that's very politically different than I. If they're a vet. So let's say that they're a vet. We're politically different. There's I definitely understand, right? It's fascinating to me how, if I just ask them, what do you think about the war,
mm-hmm.
right? And then if I ask them, do you think that this president would send his children to war,
mm-hmm.
right? How people respond and how we connect very quickly over just a question that is actually really important and meaningful. And to me, it's about getting to people's issues, right? What do people care about? What gets people going? But I feel very deeply that we can't just leave people in anger, right? Cynicism is really dangerous. And so while anger is a tool, it's always important that we go back to, like, what are we going to do, right? Yeah. Only we are going to save us. And I think a lot of people, especially as politics has become very, I don't want to say polarized, but the political system hasn't really served us in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. right? People, that's been one of the silver linings of the last 2 years, is people are more engaged than ever,
right?
Especially people that feel that they have been disenfranchised or been put out of power. They're saying, not fucking today. I'm going to get my power back.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think that there's kind of this feeling of like, oh no, there is something we can do. As mm-hmm. you know, to your point before of making people see the value of their story, the value of their experiences, and making that into, you know, actionable change, that there's this kind of palpable feeling of no, actually there is something that I could do. And, you know, to your point earlier about, you know, having those dialogues, engaging with folks, I think it always comes back to kind of speaking to their values, right? So it's about, you know, left, right, and it's everything so polarized. You know, I don't want to say polarized, but you said polarized. But if you could just speak to the values, right? Why is it that you feel this way about, you know, X, Y, and Z? And if it's, oh, it's about justice or it's about equity or whatever it is, then once you get to that root cause of what's making them feel this way, then you could kind of start doing the work there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think especially with veterans, right, there is an important and damaging dynamic where we support the troops. We support the troops and we support the troops, but we don't really ask the troops what they think, right? And we don't really ask veterans where they stand. We don't ask them their stories. They don't really hear, you know, do we hear from people like you and I who have this experience? And so I think it's really interesting how quickly people are like, oh, I totally support veterans, right? But do you know what veterans care about? And do you know that veterans care about more? Yes, we care about the VA. Great, right? Veterans also care about immigrant rights. They care about the economy. They care about foreign policy, right? So it's important to see ourselves as full citizens.
Absolutely. Yeah, and in those dialogues, when you're talking about supporting the troops, all right, well, supporting troops, supporting veterans is, you know, it's almost dismissive to say, well, I can't engage them in this conversation because it's disrespectful. You know, when we talk about certain issues, right? Right. Where folks feel like, oh no, it's disrespectful to this group of individuals. That's doing a disservice to them. That's doing a service because now you're not having the dialogue. Now you're shutting down the conversation. What have you found most rewarding about this, about the work that you've done?
How even in the most difficult of times, I mean, our country is in a really tested place, right? Communities are suffering. I was just at the border with a group of veterans, and it was really difficult. But I find a lot of hope in the potential that we have, I think, as a community. The community of progressive veterans that I have organized with over the last 2 years are some of the most incredible people I've ever met. And I think they have their own initiatives. Like, we're only just starting, right? The movement of veterans in politics and civic activity, right, is only just taking off. And so I have a lot of hope that we're only just getting started and that there's so much more that we can do together. And that we're kind of made for this, right? Like, we know what it feels like to serve for something bigger than ourselves, you know? And I can't tell you how many times I've talked to vets that are maybe shy sometimes, right? But when I talk to them, I'm like, you know what to say. When when a reporter interviews you about why you care about your community, you know exactly what to say. You know why you're running for office. You know why you're taking a stand on this issue, right? We are actually primed and prepped. The military, I say, often gave us a lot of tools to be some of the most effective organizers.
No question.
So that's what gives me a lot of hope is the community and seeing other leaders pop up and build their own initiatives.
And so let's say there's a veteran out there who's listening, but they maybe identify as a little bit more right-leaning or the things that you kind of advocate for, the policies, initiatives and things, maybe they don't necessarily see that, but they want to get involved. What would you say to that individual?
I think that there's just so much opportunity and potential for us as veterans, as a community, right? And I include military families and caretakers in that right? And what I would say is that if there's not a space, if there's a space and you don't feel like it's for you, if you don't feel like you see your community, sometimes we have to build it ourselves. And a lot of veterans have done that, especially in this city. In New York City, there are some of the most innovative vets. There's a couple of vets that just started the Black Veterans Project, right?
We interviewed him.
Which is incredibly exciting, right? And so it's really important for us to look to each other. But if it's not there, build it, you know, build it. So that's what I would say.
And to the folks who maybe don't necessarily have a direct connection to the military here in New York City. So, you know, what would you say to them? Generally, it doesn't necessarily have to be about organizing or activating, but if there's a message that you could kind of impart that you wish they knew, what would you tell them?
I mean, one of the things I feel really strongly about is that military veterans and families have played such a critical role in social movements of the United States. we have been at the forefront of almost every civil rights battle. Mm-hmm. And yet we don't really see that, right? Harriet Tubman is buried with military honors. Cesar Chavez was a Navy vet, right? Medgar Evers. There's a list of incredible American patriots that really fought for the America we know is possible. And so I would encourage anyone out there to dig deeper and to really learn the role that veterans have played as change agents.
Absolutely. Well, we're just about out of time. Thanks so much for coming in. This has been an absolute treat. So if folks want to get in touch with you, email, website, social media, how could they do that?
Yeah, pamcampos.com. And I'm on Twitter, _PamCampos.
Get those Twitter alerts. Turn them on. Your phone will be blowing out. Thanks again for being here. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Cheers.